back in the saddle again. The Meat House returned for another six-week segment. Welcome to show number, or I guess it's episode number 45. God, guys, 45 shows in the can. What do you think?
It only feels like 27.
Yeah, for you. hey, that was Ryan. Ryan was a late addition to the show, but he's an old hat now. I'll tell you, he's keeping that seat warm over there at the other side of the table. Again, welcome to the Meat House, episode number 45. And if you're listening to the show, you know where you got it from, themeathouse.com. Or you could have picked it up over at iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Podcastpedia. We try to spread it out as much as possible for everybody's enjoyment. We do have a Facebook. It's just simply The Meat House. You just go to that little Facebook daily search thingy up there and just type in The Meat House, and it'll pop right up. TheMeatHouse.com, that's where we live. Ryan Richardson in the house tonight, along with Aaron Martin, Mississippi Chris Spencer, along for the ride, Jeff Schaus. My name is J.D. Webb, and we usually task Jeff with a cruise around the Facebook world. Let's see if he found anything talking about tonight.
Yeah, actually, I've got a couple people on Facebook that I wanted to throw a quick shout-out to. There's a little bit of a theme going on tonight, and that is apparently foraged ingredients. So I found Hudson Parker over on the Meadmaker side has his entire dining room table covered with apples that he and I guess a couple other people had helped him pick off of the side of the road. It seems really early in the season for apples, but God, that's a ton of them, an absolute haul for apples. So hoping he's making some good sizer with that. And then a guy, Brewbaker on Mead, has a huge haul of spruce tips. And that grabbed my attention immediately because that's one thing that I've not actually had a sufficient harvest enough to mess with. But it's something I've been noodling around in my head as far as a new and different way to approach a metheglin for quite a while now. So
I saw that. Saw that and I thought, wait a minute. Are we talking about putting these things into a mead, making a mead out of a tree?
Well, the needles. We need to be very clear. This is the tips. So this is the brand new growth for spring. You obviously don't harvest all of it because then the tree doesn't get any new growth that year. And then once you've got those tips, you selectively harvest the green needles. You don't put any of the branches, the twiggy stuff, the woody stuff in your mead. So it's kind of like putting the leaves of a tree in there, kind of like a tea, except in this case it's a conifer. It's a spruce.
Okay. And it's going to come out tasting like what? Pine?
It's a little bit piney. It's a little bit minty. It has a kind of a slightly citrus taste depending on the species. I hear Douglas fir and blue spruce have a very citrusy flavor to them. And it's kind of got a little bit of a resin flavor from the pine content. I mean, it's apparently a very interesting flavor. I mean, it can also have some kind of a gin flavor just because of the use of spruce tips in some brands of gin as well. So it might be a little bit reminiscent of that. But it's one of those things that I've not actually gotten to try yet. But I know it's a common ingredient, especially in like Iceland, Norway, Sweden. They make a few indigenous alcohols with those. So really interesting to try some of that myself, actually.
Yeah, that opens up a whole new world, doesn't it? Here, try some of my cottonwood mead. wow. That's interesting. That's maybe something that we should pursue and see if we can get some more information and do some research on that. Anything else, Jeff?
I actually had a conversation with one of our listeners this morning regarding carbonating. Eli King sent us a direct message on the Facebook side asking about the best way to carbonate mead. And I kind of threw in my two cents. I said, hey, you know, from what I've seen, from what I've done, bottle carbonation can be a little bit dicey, especially as you get higher into the alcohol content. The yeast just don't want to work that hard. From what I've seen, force carbonating either with a keg or from with one of the carbonation caps that you and I are fans of, JD, gets really good, really consistent results. But I did want to throw it across the table and see if you guys had any input, like to the contrary or in addition to what I threw out there too.
Yeah, I've done a couple of different methods of carbonating. I've spoken to them both, I think, on the show before. I typically bottle carbonate using typically corn sugar. And if I need to, I'll add, I've used both CBC1 yeast as well as EC1118. Now, the strongest mead that I think I've ever carbonated was about 9%. I mean, bottle carbonate, right around 9. So I think it was even, below 10. I've had no issues at all doing that. Now, I've never tried to bottle carbonate a 14, 15, 16%. So I can't speak to experience from that one. Bottle carbonating has always worked well for me. And then the other one that I think we talked about this, almost a year ago now. But I also have a nitro, set up on a keg, and I've put some of my meads on nitro and carbonated them that way also to a great success. I think that, nitro does tend to change the flavor profile just a little bit. It makes it a little creamier. It rounds off the edges a little bit more. I'd keep that in mind a little bit if you're using something very, very delicate or you want to be careful of not manipulating the flavors. But both bottle carving and on nitro have worked well for me.
Interesting. Chris?
I would love to try a nitro mead. That's just a really interesting concept. I mean, I love what nitro does to beer and can imagine that would be pretty phenomenal on a mead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chris, did you have any, you do some pretty high alcohol stuff, don't you?
I do, and I don't really care for it carbonated. You all know I'm not really the hydromel type guy, session mead. I'm more of the, wine-like mead that I make. But with that said, I do have an occasional hydromel. I've got a good, a little fruit, session mead that I make, and, I've done it both ways. So at the alcohol level we're talking about where I would carbonate, the yeast is not an issue. It'll definitely bottle carb. So I started out bottle carbing, I got a keg set up and I went to that. And then when my keg went kaput, I had some things I did want to carb and I went back to bottle carbing. And I don't know. There's a little something about bottle carbing and bottle conditioning that just seems a little bit more traditional, kind of like cask conditioning or something. It was done that way a long time before kegging came along, and I got a soft spot for historical ways of doing things. So I don't know. I sort of tend to go toward the bottle carbing, but like I said, if it was up in alcohol and it was starting to get dicey as to whether or not the yeast would do it, I wouldn't hesitate to go back into the keg. So either way, I don't think there's really a downside.
Yeah. Well, and also if you're going to do, if you're going to bottle carb, you got to be careful and not stabilize, otherwise you run the risk of the yeast, not being viable enough to create a carbonation when you go ahead and when you bottle it. So With that being said, you pretty much got to let it ride and stay away from all the stabilizers, right?
Yeah, you do. And that, I guess I said there was no downside. I guess that would be a downside to bottle conditioning, is that you can't have a sweet bottle conditioned mead. You know, there are people out there who talk about letting it bottle condition and then trying to pasteurize it or cold crash it or something, and that's just asking for trouble. You're just asking for exploding bottles at that point, and I just wouldn't try it. So,
yeah.
If I want it sweet, it's going in a keg. If not, bottle conditioning is fine with me.
Well, I don't, you know, I mean, kegs, you know, you can get a pretty decent little keg set up, a single keg and a bottle regulator and everything for, you know, what, right around $150. So, that's a relatively inexpensive little setup if you want to do some keg. That's how I carbonate all of my stuff, is in the keg, force carb, and I've had real good luck with it so far. I mean, I'd like to give the nitro a shot, but that's another one of those things. I mean, I got to brew some really good beer for my wife to explain to her why I need to spend $300 on a nitro setup. So I'm not quite there yet, Ryan.
Well, I think you got a case to make.
Yeah,
it's easier to ask forgiveness than permission sometimes.
Yeah. Well,
he's right.
Yeah, that's true. Cool. All right, guys. Did we, Jeff? I hope we helped your person out there.
Oh yeah, I think so. I mean, we've covered a pretty wide range of the topics. You know, I didn't even think to mention, hey, by the way, if you're going to want something sweet, you really need to force carb that, because of course, you know, you're risking bottle bombs, in unpredictability from that regard too.
Absolutely.
And I think he mentioned he was looking at making a soda mead, that was kind of a running thing on, the Mead Maker podcast at some point last year. And I haven't heard much about that, but you know, I was interested to hear, you know, what he had idea wise, and so he's going to drop me a line. Yeah, something along the lines of either, you know, like a lemon lime soda or root beer mead or
like that mountain. What wasn't Ryan talking about a Mountain Dew thing here a while back, a couple weeks ago? Or
yeah, there was a guy who made a Mountain Dew mead using actual Mountain Dew. You know, haven't tried it. Don't know much about it. I'm not sure if I'll ever get to it, but found his posting on it online, and it was neon green. I mean, it was radioactive green.
There you go. All right. Well, good stuff. And, you know, keep the questions coming. We certainly appreciate it. We're going to deal with a couple of them here later on in the show. And then for all you folks out there asking about the heart murmur, get your paper and pencil out, because Chris is going to run through the recipe here just shortly. And we'll also see if we can't get it posted up on, if we don't already. It might even be there. I don't know. But we'll get it posted up on the website and on the Facebook page for sure. But right now, guys, what are we drinking? I'm going to start this one off. I'm drinking, this is a, it's basically a Polish ale, but of course I twisted it up a little bit. And, you know, doing my braggot thing, I caramelized, I'm fascinated with this. I don't know who got me started on this, what do you call them? Slow cooker, crock pot caramelizing thing. But, dude, I mean, I'm digging it, way more control over that than doing it in the pressure cooker. So I caramelized 4 pounds of wildflower, just past the marshmallow stage. It's much darker, not as dark as some of the burnt stuff that I've done in the pressure cooker, but it did certainly turn a couple of shades darker. It's just past the marshmallow, almost to that roasty. You get a real good caramel aroma off of it, and not quite the roasted burnt marshmallow. It's a light malt extract with Munich, 8 ounces of Munich, 6 ounces of Crystal, Styrian Goldings hops at 60 minutes. And I tossed in a half ounce of nuggets at like, I don't know, like 15 minutes, 20 minutes, something like that. Had them laying around. I figured, what the hell? 6.6% alcohol, carbonated, and left it set for a few weeks while we were on vacation. I think I kegged it on the 6th of April. Got it carved up and just let it set. I get a real nice honey aroma off of it, so that's a good thing. It tastes good. This is a wonderful summertime drink. And this is a beer kit from, now I forget. I'll have to go back to Facebook and post it up there. I don't remember where I got this kit from. It's not from your typical kit. It's not a Northern Brewer or a Midwest Supply, but it came out pretty good. I'm thrilled with it. So that's what I'm drinking tonight. Darren, what you got in your cup?
So tonight I am drinking a Blatt's Light. This is just a light American Pilsner style beer. Established in Milwaukee back in 1851. So one of the beers that made Milwaukee famous.
The beer that made Milwaukee famous. That sounds good. Jeff, what's in your glass tonight?
Well, a few weeks ago, I decided to try my hand at one of Ricky the Mead Maker's brews, see how that worked out. Because, you know, since that since his guest episode, I have been insanely curious. And you know, I'll be damned if it didn't work out really nicely. I did Valkyrie's Choice, his recipe for that, and I did it as close to as possible as he has posted it on his website. It has turned out very nice. I used some Alberta Canada honey, and I think his is from Ontario. He just says Canadian wildflower honey, which I think is a pretty wide spectrum. But it's come out, you know, super light. It's very, you know, it's got that great fruity flavor to it. But the kind of that sweet perception of sweetness, even though it is bone dry, carbonated really well. I used the carb cap in a couple 2 liter bottles because I only made a gallon of it. I wasn't sure how this is going to turn out. And I am pleasantly surprised that this worked out as promised.
Wow. And you made it through that 80-degree fermentation temp with no problems.
Yeah, I actually upcycled an old aquarium that my wife had gotten tired of having fish in, and the heater there is an adjustable heat kind of a thing. So I got it rigged up. It fluctuated a little bit, I think, between 84 and 86 when it was supposed to stay at 86, but it seemed to do the job just fine. And you know, I like it. The wife likes it. I think I'm going to be able to talk her into keeping the aquarium fermenter going for a little while longer, so I can try a couple different recipes and try to put my own spin on a few of these too.
Yeah, you could even toss a few fish in that float around in there, like a, you know, as your jugs of meat are sitting in the aquarium, toss some goldfish or something in there and let them float around.
It'd probably be more than happy to share some space, I'm sure.
Chris, what are you drinking tonight, bud?
I wasn't going to tell you, but I think I'm going to because I'm in that kind of mood.
Uh-oh.
Okay. So the other day I got the deal of the century on some thinly sliced ribeye. And one of my favorite things in the world, although I shouldn't be eating it, is Philly cheesesteaks.
Yeah.
So since I got this deal on all this thinly sliced ribeye, I mean, I filled up the freezer. I've been pigging out on cheesesteaks.
Oh, dude.
So as a consequence, tonight I am got a cup of Tazo's Smooth Move tea.
What? Oh, God.
I mean, you want to be honest? I'm being perfectly honest here. And it's good.
Oh, my God. Only from Mississippi.
Yeah. Oh, well, hey, you got to do what you got to do, you know?
Yeah. We're trying to get Ryan back here. Ryan, did you come back?
Yeah.
Dude, talk to your phone company.
Yeah.
Tell your phone company you need to stay connected to the show. You're up, Ryan. What are you drinking?
I am drinking a beer that I made quite a while back. You know, it doesn't fit into any style. You know, we've talked about that. Nothing I make fits neatly into a style, but it's kind of a hoppy brown ale that was actually lagered. It's nice. It had gotten a little bit astringent. You know, it's a bottle carbonated beer that had been around for quite a while, and I'm sure it will pass its prime. But these last couple bottles, and this is one of the things you got to be careful about when you bottle condition. These last couple bottles were somewhat over carbonated. You know, they weren't bottle bombs. They weren't, you know, I mean, they're just on the edge of what I'd call a gusher. Of, you know, you open it up and it starts foaming out. You know, this kind of over carbonation in the bottle has actually turned these last few into something really pleasant to drink. It's totally changed the flavor a little bit and, you know, really muted that little bit of astringency that was coming through. So I'm pleasantly surprised. I should say that's something you need to be careful about when you bottle condition. If you're doing it where the way that I did this one was I took some corn sugar and I boiled it into a simple syrup. And then I put the simple syrup in the bottom of a bottling bucket and then racked the beer on top of it and, you know, gave it a little bit of a stir and then bottled it off of that. You know, you can buy those I think they're called fizz drops, which it basically looks like a hard candy.
Yeah.
And you drop those in the bottle and then each bottle would be, you know, exactly carbonated the same way. But this, you know, this is something that you can, if you don't mix it carefully enough, which can be a little tough to do because you don't want to aerate it. It can happen. I think this is what we talked about a little bit too about some of Aaron's meads, where we were drinking the same mead from the same batch, but we were experiencing different levels of carbonation from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, as everybody knows, I took 2 weeks off and left town. I don't know what you guys did, but I had a hell of a good time. Wife and I left out of here, went to Williams, Arizona, and spent 4 days there. It's a cool little town. And then drove up to the Grand Canyon, only about 50 minutes away. It's a nice drive. And I'll tell you, if you guys have not physically stood on the rim of the Grand Canyon, we happen to be on the south rim. I tell you, you're in for a treat. It is the most awe-inspiring thing. I once had an opportunity to see Mount Rushmore, and I remember the hair standing up on the back of my neck and just gazing at this monstrous thing carved into the side of this mountain. I had the same feeling when I was standing, looking down, thousands of feet into the Grand Canyon, into the Colorado River. Just amazing, simply amazing. I encourage you to go and see that if you haven't seen it yet. But 1,685 pictures later, I've got lots of work ahead of me. Some of them I've got put up on my Facebook. You can go there and see them. I think I sent Chris a couple of them because I know he doesn't Facebook. Chris, one of those. Chris, Mississippi is one of those anti social media types. And probably a good thing too. If you haven't been in the Grand Canyon, absolutely put that on your list and go do that. If you don't do anything else, go do that. It's the most amazing thing you'll ever witness in your life. With that being said, let's move into some emails that we got. Going to start off with Angie Colwell. She is an avid fan, and I love the back or the bottom of her email. It says she absolutely adores us. So, terrific to have such a great fan. Angie, thank you very much. And we're going to tackle the question that you had. And guys, I remember talking about this. This is back on, I think, episode 27, as she put in her email. And she basically says that, I'll just read it verbatim. She says, "Forgive me, I have to go back to episode 27. Please tell me that I misunderstood Jeff, but me judge implied that if a braggart was entered into a competition without the required 50% or more honey as fermentable sugar, no one would know." So we tossed that around in an email back and forth amongst us before the show. And I thought Jeff and Ryan came up with some pretty good explanations. And one thing off the bat, the Mead House does not encourage anybody to cheat or to bend the rules. We encourage you to follow the rules, whoever lays them out or whatever rules your competition happens to go by. Absolutely, be obedient and follow the rules.
But if it's in my favor, I can overlook an occasional mistake.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But let's go to. I'm going to turn this over to Jeff because she was basically addressing this to Jeff.
Yeah.
Let's try to help Angie out here and see if we can't answer this question.
So I think the first thing we need to address is the notion that a braggart has to be more than 50% fermentable sugars from honey. I don't think that's accurate at all. If you look at the BJCP guidelines, that's not listed anywhere in there. Really what the BJCP guidelines are looking for is a harmonious mixture of beer quality and mead quality or honey quality. I know I, for one, have quoted that same rule at least once on the show, if not more than once. And I think I was in the wrong because it has been pointed out, and we've pointed it out on a couple different shows, that is not a hard and fast rule. It's not a requirement for a bracket to be at least 50% honey. That seems to be an infelicitous rule that has been floated around quite a bit. It's kind of seeped into the popular culture of mead making, but I don't think it is accurate in any stretch of the imagination.
It's funny you should say that because on a previous show, people in authority on the subject said the same thing, that
right.
Braggarts have to be 51% of the fermentables. And I'm thinking, you know, I can remember even back then, well, how would you know if it wasn't written down somewhere? How would you know? You know?
Right.
But go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just,
yeah,
you know.
It is a popular misconception, a really popular misconception, that, like I said, even I have fallen prey to it. By the same token, though, you know, one of our previous esteemed guests, Michael Fairbrother, who is, you know, he is a massive mead maker and a braggot maker of his own accord, even quoted us on, or quoted to us in the show that, you know, a great way to just make your own braggot is to take a pound or two of grain out of your grain bill, replace it with a pound or two of honey. That is, for most, like, all grain brews, if we're talking about a 5-gallon batch, a pound or two is going to be maybe 20% of your fermentables. It's not going to be anywhere near 50%. It may be a lot less than 20% of your fermentables. It could, depending on the grain bill, it could be less than 10% of your fermentables, really. What the BJCP, which is the governing body and the one that sets the rules for most of these competitions in the United States, suggests is that harmonious interaction between, you know, the beer qualities and the meat qualities. And I think that is what we need to strive for. I mean, it has to be, in my way of thinking, and I said this in email, the ideal braggot is, it's something that is greater than the sum of its beer qualities and its honey qualities. The two, when mixed together, make something even better. And I think that's what you're going for over a raw, a goal of, you know, 50% something and 50% something else, or 60, 40, or anything like that. It's the quality and not the quantity that we need to be concerned with.
Yeah. And, you know, I know, and I don't, I was on the Brewer's Friend. I used that to do some recipe work and everything. That brewersfriend.com, and I remember reading, and I've gone back and tried to find it again, and I can't, but I remember reading somewhere on that site that you know, it doesn't have to be 50%. I mean, it could be as little as 20%, but the whole idea, like you say, is for that honey to have some effect in either aroma or flavor, and it doesn't have to be 50%. Some of the recipes that I looked at are maybe 20% or 30%, you know, and I know that some of the work that I've done on my recipes, you know, taking some of these beer ingredients and recipes and kind of messing around, replacing grains and replacing LME or DME with the honey, even going as high as 50%, boy, that cranks the ABV way up. You know, and maybe you like that. That's fine and good. But it's far beyond where I like to be. I like to stay below the 12, 11% mark. And that seems to be around 25 to 30, 33%. You know, as far as the honey goes. So, you know, here again, I have no idea why, you know, like I said, I've been told by people in authority that, you know, your braggot has to be 51%, you know, honey. Okay. If it's not written down on the bottle, how would you know?
Right.
You know,
and this is another point. I mean,
yeah.
I've entered a number of competitions. I've judged a couple, and in none of these competitions have I been asked to submit my recipe, or as far as quantities of honey and other grains or any other ingredients go. They ask for the ingredients. They don't ask for quantities. The judges are really only supplied that brief listing of ingredients, which in my case is usually like, you know, wildflower honey and a fruit and or a spice or something along those lines. They're not given the full recipe. So we have no preconceived notion going into the judging as to how much honey is in it and how much grain is in it. The idea, again, is just a good flavor. That's all we're looking for, you know, to make the best braggot.
Yeah. I'll jump in here and go a little further. First of all, what Jeff was saying here with the BJCP being the governing body, and let's just stop there for a second. The BJCP guidelines are what is used by the Mazer Cup, Mead Free or Die, and the Michigan Beer Cup, which is where Angie was telling us that she was also participating. So, I mean, this isn't a different set of rules than is used by even the Mazer Cup or something else. You know, this is the big overarching, umbrella organization, guideline. And I've got the descriptions up here, and I'm just going to quickly just go through a couple of key phrases here. Again, he said Jeff said a harmonious blend of mead and beer, distinctive characteristics of both. Beer flavors tend to somewhat mask typical honey flavors. Displays a balanced character identifiable as both a beer and a mead. If a beer style is declared, the braggot should have some characteristics traceable to the style, although the flavors will be different because of the presence of honey. If a honey variety is declared, the braggot should feature a subtle to prominent varietal character. You can even make it a couple different ways. Braggot is a mead made with both honey and malt, providing flavor and fermentable extract. Originally and alternatively, it can be made as a mixture of mead and ale. Finished mead and ale can be mixed together. Any type of honey, any type of beer, it tells you what it should be like. And as you read through this, the style and what makes a braggot is how it's perceived, not necessarily what it's, any levels of honey and malt and hop and that kind of thing. Now, the legal scholar in me always tries to find the other side of the argument. And if you go up to the original, the start of the BJCP mead style guidelines under standard description for mead, under ingredients, it does say mead is made primarily from honey, water, and yeast. Yeah. So, that is the standard description for mead. However, I understand how that could cause some confusion, as people might read that and say, well, primarily means a majority. It means 50% plus one. I believe when you get to the style, the individual styles, of M4A, which is braggot, the M4A style guidelines would supersede the standard description, because nowhere here, again, does it say the words primary, let alone any percent. So, we're not trying to be hard on anybody. We're not trying to say you're wrong or you're a bad person or anything like that. We're just saying that there's some fake news going on out there on the blogosphere of people believing that there's this rule which does not exist, or this requirement which does not exist. Lastly, what I'm also going to say is, if you flip over to the beer style guidelines and you thumb down to category 31B, which is alternative sugar beer, you know, it says alternative fermentables in beer is a standard beer with additional fermentable sugars, example, honey, brown sugar, molasses, maple syrup, etc. And in that description there, it says a harmonious marriage of the sugar, you know, which could be honey, and beer, but still recognizable as a beer. The sugar
and Ryan,
character should, yeah.
If I could put something in there, harmonious blend. If you're trying to accomplish that for a competition, you cannot lock yourself into a certain amount of honey, because obviously if your base beer style is a porter or a stout, you're going to have to use a lot less malt and a lot more honey for the honey to come through and achieve a harmonious blend. If you were making a cream ale braggot, then you could get by with a lot less honey, and you might even need to increase your beer component. So achieving that harmonious blend is going to determine a lot of what your percentages are.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I want to touch on that. I just want to finish my thought here in that I can see that how there can also be confusion between what would make an alternative sugar beer and what would make a braggot. And I think, and this is me, this is pure conjecture, but I've also heard people in authority positions say it incorrectly, that they, oh, well, if it's less than 50%, you know, honey, it's a beer. And if it's more than 50% honey, it's a braggot. There's definitely, when you read this, gray area. You could produce a braggot that could be both viable as an M4A braggot and a 31B, which is alternative sugar beer. There's definitely gray area there. There is not a clear line, and it depends, because they both call for a harmonious marriage or harmonious blend of both, you know, that honey and beer. The last thing I was going to say about Chris, what you just mentioned is exactly true. I did a stout with equal parts malt extract and honey, you know, 6 pounds of each. And the honey was extremely hard to pick up in that. Extremely hard to pick up. There's also some specialty grains. And then I did a light beer, you know, lighter in color and density and just overall weight, I'd call it. And there is, I mean, it's about 30% honey, and that honey is coming through, you know, very strong.
That's I want to push it back over to Jeff's side of the table. This whole thing, Jeff, I mean, it almost sounds like it's very subjective when it comes to the judge. I mean, how, you know, you got to make the call, I guess, right?
Well, and yes and no. I mean, it does ultimately depend on how someone wants to enter it. I mean, the judge is not there to decide whether or not a particular mead or a particular entry fits in one category or another, especially not between a mead category and a beer category. The judge is there to determine, one, how good the mead is, and, you know, if there is a discrepancy between the style guidelines and the quality of the mead, where that mead is deficient in that style guideline.
Well, I should have clarified what I had meant was, you have to determine, now one judge, you know, I don't think any two judges are the same, and they're certainly not going to perceive things the same way, exact way. So if you've got a braggot and you get all kinds of honey aromas out of it, but yet the judge sitting next to you doesn't quite get that, or do you think that you think it's actually much closer than that? That's what I meant by subjective. So, I mean, it could be one person perceives it one way, another judge might perceive it a completely different way. You know, when we're dealing with braggots. Obviously, if you're making a berry melomel, it better taste like raspberry or blackberry or blueberry. Otherwise, it's a big fail, right? And there better be some honey aroma. So, but when it comes to braggots, I mean,
yeah, the needle for harmonious blend is probably very subjective, I would assume. I mean, there is a possibility that, sure, some judges may say, oh, that's, you know, that's too much honey, that's too much grain. I'm not getting any honey character whatsoever out of this, or the grain character is really light. This honey that, you know, you use buckwheat honey, and that's just drowning out all of this this light malt flavor that you've got going on. This just doesn't work for me. You know, at the end of the day, though, I think while there may be some subjectivity here, we're still talking about making the best mead you can make. Yeah. And I kind of say, you know, it has to come down to faith that the best mead you can make, the mead that you are proud of and want to send to competition, is going to get judged that way.
Yeah. Well, Andrea, I know we probably took it a couple of steps further, but I hope you get the gist of what we're saying here. That one, we've discovered that there really isn't a rule about 51% of anything being in a braggot. You know, and I mean that leaves it to be a pretty open. You know, as far as your own perception, I mean, how much honey do you want to put in your braggot? It's got to be enough, obviously, so that you get some characters of honey coming through. But you got to figure that out in your own recipe, I guess, and you know, and come up with something that works. So,
interestingly enough, as a side note, The Michigan Mead Cup is actually where my Porter Boucher Braggot took home an honorable mention last year.
Awesome. Awesome. And, you know, we should probably try to get Angie on the show. I don't know where she lives, but we should try to get her on the show sometime. So I guess that's it on the braggots, guys. We're pretty satisfied. We took care of Angie's question pretty good here.
I think so.
Good. You know, a lot of people have been contacting Chris regarding, and he's mentioned this many times before on the show, the Heart Murmur Project, which is a kind of a, well, let's let Chris explain it. Chris, tell us about the Heart Murmur.
Well, as I said before, it's been a long time coming to get this thing where it needed to be. It's basically a take on Ken Schramm's Heart of Darkness. It's regarded by a lot of people as probably one of the best meads in the world. And if you don't live around there, you're going to have a hard time getting some unless you know someone there. And even then, you got to get on a waiting list and stand in line, and you may not get any. So I was not ever under the notion that I could create it perfectly. I knew I couldn't, but I wanted to set out to do something that everyone could make. And at least get the gist of it, find out what it's all about using ingredients that everyone can get. So several tests and I came up with something that I have no idea whether it's like the original or not, because I've never had it. I came up with this thing by going online and reading reviews of the original, and I wrote down every description that I could find of it, and then I went through and I picked out the most common ones. What was the descriptors that people used over and over to describe it? And that's what I kind of shot for.
That's how you put your recipe together, right?
Yeah, that's how I started the recipe and then made changes in order to achieve that, and ended up scoring a 42 and a 45 at the Mazer Cup with it, which I don't think is too bad. So everybody's been asking, what's the recipe? Can you give me the recipe? And I can't even begin to tell you how many people I've had emailing and asking about that. So rather than take 2 hours to write it out again, I'm just going to do it here. So get your pen and paper, and and we'll put it together here. This is going to turn out to end up 5 gallons. Your starting gravity, your original gravity, is going to be 1162. That's 1.162. Your final gravity, your final gravity is going to be somewhere in the 1050-ish range, probably 1056 to 1058. But anywhere in the 1050s will be okay. Mine finished at 1056, I believe it was. So here's your ingredients to start with. Your first is going to be 2 quarts of Fruit Fast Tart Cherry Concentrate. This is made with 99% Morello and 1%, I believe it's 1% Montmorency or Balaton, but it's primarily Morello. You're going to need 2 quarts of that. We're only going to use 1.5 quarts. For your raspberries, you can use 15 pounds of frozen or fresh raspberries, or you can use 12 pounds of the Vintner's Harvest seedless puree. That's your choice. And for the black currants, you're going to need 4 pounds of black currants if you're using whole or fresh. If you're going to use the black currant puree that's seedless from Vintner's Harvest, you're going to use about 3.5 pounds, maybe. And that difference is just accounting for the seeds. If you get the black currant puree from Vintner's Harvest, make sure you don't get the fruit wine base that contains sugar. Make sure you get just the puree that doesn't have anything else added. And the same goes for the raspberries. So then you're going to need wildflower honey. That's going to be up to your choice. I would suggest trying to find something that is heavy on the floral, but not so heavy on the herbal and grassy notes. Usually a good northern wildflower honey. I mixed mine with a northern wildflower honey and also with the honey that JD sent me from California. So, but you're going to need at least 2 gallons, probably. And it might not hurt to have a few extra quarts sitting around just to be on the safe side. It's going to depend on the sugar content. You're going to need GoFirm Protect Rehydration Nutrient. You're going to need Lauvin 71B, 15 grams of that, or 3 packets. You're going to need your choice of Firmaid K or Firmaid O. And for this particular mead, I would strongly suggest Firmaid K. You're going to need some potassium carbonate or potassium bicarbonate. And you're going to need 3 teaspoons of pectic enzyme. So for your fermenter, you're going to need to have a very, very large bucket. I would go like a 7.9-gallon minimum, and I strongly suggest you get a 10-gallon food-grade bucket. You're going to need that space, especially when you start mixing and degassing. 8 gallons is pushing it really close. So here's what you're going to do. If you're using fresh or frozen fruits, you're going to need to crush the raspberries and currants. If not, if you're using the puree, just pour them in the bucket. And if you have to crush your fruit, try not to crush the seeds. Just make sure you mash the fruit up good. You're going to use 1.5 quarts of the tart cherry juice and 10.5 quarts of water. That's the proper dilution for that. And then you're going to begin to add your honey, and you're going to need a drill-mounted stirrer in order to mix it up good. And so you want to end up with a gravity of 1162 and a volume, total volume, of 6 gallons or maybe slightly more. And so you may have to sort of play back and forth with honey and maybe a little water to get that gravity and volume. So once you've got that gravity and volume, you're going to use the GoFirm and rehydrate your yeast per protocol. And you're going to follow the TOSNA nutrient method. Go to meadmaderight.com and look at the TOSNA method for calculating nutrients using Fermade K rather than Fermade O. The reason I prefer Fermade K for this is because we're creating a lot of stress here, both in low pH, high starting gravity, and I think that in this particular case, I think the yeast will benefit from that small amount of DAP that's in there. So we're going to follow that protocol. We're going to ferment all the way through 28 days, and we're going to keep it at 62 degrees Fahrenheit. The fermentation temperature here is very important because, as I said, we're creating enough stress already, and we don't want high temperatures to create more stress. So keep this thing around 62 degrees Fahrenheit. You're going to stir, aerate, degas twice daily, no more. Don't go and start stirring 3 or 4 times a day. Only do it twice a day. Now, here's where the potassium carbonate comes in. When you do your first nutrient addition, you're going to add 1.5 teaspoons of potassium carbonate. And then you're going to add another 1.5 teaspoons on your third nutrient addition. This helps with buffering the pH. Whether or not it raises the pH any, I doubt that amount would, but it's probably insignificant, but it helps with buffering. All right, so I said we're going to aerate, degas twice daily for the first third of fermentation, or the first 7 days. And then you're just going to let it sit. And all of this is done under airlock, by the way. Let it sit in primary 28 days. Get you a stainless steel scouring pad. Wash it with PBW and rinse it well, and cover the end of your racking cane, and that'll keep the pulp out when you rack it. Rack it over into a glass 5-gallon carboy, top up with water. Put it back in your fermentation fridge for 30 days at about 45 degrees. After 30 days, rack off the sediment into another carboy and top up with water. And in that carboy, you want to have 5 crushed Camden tablets. And don't be afraid of topping up with water both times, because this is a strong mead. It's highly acidic. It's and that little bit of dilution that you're going to create with topping up is not going to hurt it at all. So you probably won't even have to top up on the first racking into secondary anyway. But if you do, don't worry about it. Top it up. And so now we're just going to let that thing set and age and settle and clear. After 45 degrees for 30 days, it's going to be pretty much settled out anyway. But let it bulk age there for as long as you want. And if you let it sit in bulk aging for 2 or 3 months, I like to go ahead and into my bottling bucket, I like to add 2.5 more crushed Camden tablets. The ideal situation here would be if you had a free SO2 test kit, but a lot of people don't have those and they don't want to invest in one. So if you don't have one, just put another 2.5 crushed Camden tablets in your bottling bucket, rack into it and bottle it. You probably want to bottle this in 375s. And I think we talked on another show about closures that we liked. I've been using the Noma corks. They work really well, but just be aware that you're going to need a floor corker. A hand corker will completely destroy those synthetic corks, and it just won't work. I've not found one that would. So get the floor corker with the plastic jaws, the plastic Irish jaws and Noma corks or whatever you choose. And that's about it.
That sounds good.
Man, add that to my to brew list. Chris, I was
it's
curious.
An expensive batch.
Yeah.
Now, no kidding. Chris, I have used the it's a hand corker. It's called a single level corker. I think they're Italian made, and they work well with the synthetic corks. That's what they're designed for. But yeah, you're right. Though I would not use that Portuguese, you know, double action corker that most people are familiar with as the, you know, as the hand corker.
Yeah, the double lever corkers, they don't work at all. I don't know about that. I know that single lever corker. I think it's called the Gilda or something like that.
Right.
That might work. Yeah, I haven't tried that, but I've got the Portuguese floor corker, and it works like a charm. But if you're using regular corks, it's not an issue.
Yeah.
This Chris, is a. Oh, go ahead, Aaron.
I was just wondering, so you mentioned that part of what went into your recipe formulation was reading some of the reviews and descriptions that other people had posted. And this is just, it's a mead that's really just like enchanting to me. You know, you read about this mead and, you know, I follow or I'm friends with Ken Schramm on Facebook and occasionally he'll post about it. And just the blood, sweat, and tears that he puts into every drop of this mead, it's just an enchanting mead to me. So I'm curious, either from your own review of your own mead or even just the descriptions that you've read of other people, like how would you describe this thing to me or to a listener that hasn't had this style or this type of mead before?
Well, the honey is not going to jump out at you for sure because there's so much fruit. It's to be so heavy and dark, it's not heavy and dark at all. When you pop the cork on a bottle, the whole room smells like fruit immediately. But the honey is somewhat masked, even though you're looking at, geez, like 24 pounds of honey or something.
Yeah.
So even with that much, there's so much fruit there that it's masked. But it's just a really smooth, fruity, velvety almost. It's and it comes across almost as dry. In fact, on my score sheets, someone said, one of the judges made a comment about it being dry. Let me look at this real quickly. And I will read some of the ways the judges described it. Very high, fresh, crushed cherries on the aroma. The aroma tells me that the cherries are in the forefront. And then the next comment says, I can almost taste it just by smelling it. No discernible honey character in the aroma. The fruit opens up even more and fills the room when I swirl the glass. If you go down to flavor and overall impression of it, it says the meat is in perfect balance with acidity. No sweetness detected. It says, if this is a sack mead, you have done an excellent job. It's hard to believe that this is actually a sack mead because it is so super smooth, almost luscious in its flavor.
Wow.
Those are just some of the ways it was described. It says it doesn't seem nearly as sweet as it is, which is funny when you've got a final gravity of 1056 or so.
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah. One of the judges said that it seemed almost as though the raspberries were trying to take over, but then the cherries jump back in. It says the sweetness builds and then the acidity comes in and washes it away. So, it's just unlike anything else. And to be made with, ingredients from the grocery store for the most part, or readily available ingredients, I don't think that's too bad.
Not at all.
It sounds awesome. I mean, this, as you're reading the descriptions, this is the kind of mead that I want to make. And again, it's not to say that, I really enjoy a good session mead and lighter-bodied meads, but to me, there's just something special about this style, and this is like at the forefront of my to brew list is something like this. So thank you for sharing that recipe, Chris. I know I have certainly been looking forward to hearing that recipe, as I'm sure the other guys on the show and just all of our listeners as well. So that was really interesting to hear that.
Well, I've been on a soapbox before about changing the recipe and all, and I know it's human nature to want to experiment. Believe me, I did all the experimentation on this that could be done. And if you want to tinker around with a recipe and try to make it your own, go for it. But trust me on this one. This one needs to be made to the recipe. There's a balance there that has to be reached. And just a little bit of too much, especially when you're dealing with fruit like a black currant that can just completely take over everything. An extra quarter or half pound here or there can just really throw everything off.
I've known Chris going on probably 3+ years now, when I first met him several years back, he'd already had significant time put in on this project then. But this has been a career lifelong. I don't know how would you describe it, but
career-ending experiment.
Well, and what's so cool about this is, like you were saying, Chris, you're making this recipe accessible to everyone. I mean, these are ingredients that you can just get at the grocery store and order online. You know, I think part of what's to go back to my description of this mead is just sounding so enchanting of what Ken does is, you know, he, from my understanding, and you guys may know, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's got like an orchard on site and, you know, he grows a lot of his own fruit, if not all of the fruit for this recipe. And, you know, he provides individual care and for the plants, and he handpicks his fruit at peak ripeness. And I mean, like I was saying earlier, just the immense amount of blood, sweat, and tears that he puts into every drop of this mead is just kind of mind boggling to me. But what you've done is you've taken that and made it accessible to the home mead maker. And I think that's so cool. That's just so cool.
Well, at least I think I have. I don't know if I have or not. I know I created a good mead. If I tasted the actual Heart of Darkness, I might say, well, I'm nowhere even close. But you know what? Whether I'm close or not, I've created a mead that I'm really proud of. Yeah. To get 45 out of 50 at the Mazer Cup in one of the most contested categories, I'm happy with that. I got no complaints. So it's a good mead, however you look at it, whether or not it's a good copy of that one or not. So,
well, it's been a passion. I mean, I know it's been a passionate thing for you as much as we've talked about this thing in the past and going way back when I first met you. This has been a mission of yours. And I mean that, and I absolutely mean that. I mean, this has been a mission that you've been on. I mean, you can tell the passion that you have put into this project, you know, have standing results. So, this is what we do. I've got the same passion. I just haven't quite identified. I'm in the range now. I know the style of mead that I really like. And so now I'm, you know, whether it's the stout type, a porter type, this Polish ale thing, whatever it is, my orange thing that I've done. Now I'm starting to narrow down, what I really want to work on. I want to find a couple that I really want to spend some time on and perfect, like you've done with this Hartmer. It is about doing this home mead making thing. This is what turns me on with this hobby, and that's why I enjoy doing it. So you know, congratulations on the results from the Mazer Cup with it. And, you know, like the boys say, thanks for sharing the recipe, you know, for the world. So,
well, I hope someone out there makes it and gets good results from it.
Sure. We got another email, guys, from David. I don't know what his last name is. I didn't see it on the email. I think I forwarded it to you guys. It's probably a couple of before we left on vacation. He's curious about the difference between aging in a carboy versus aging in a bottle. He wants to know, is there a difference? And can he just leave a 1 gallon carboy with an airlock for a year to age? So let's help David out with the answer here. And let's push it over to Aaron. What do you think, Aaron?
You know, it's an interesting question for sure. Definitely, in my opinion, you can bulk age in a carboy. And in fact, I think there's a lot of advantages to doing that. You know, I think one of the pitfalls that I've ran into in my own personal experience with mead making is just running out of patience. I think, you know, mead making, one of the most key aspects of making a good mead is having patience, and especially if you're allowing that mead to clarify naturally over time, where all of the, you know, the yeast and suspension just naturally settles out due to the gravity pulling it down. And one of the pitfalls I've ran into is sometimes running out of patience and bottling prematurely, where, you know, you'll get just a little bit of haze in the bottle, or a little bit of yeast sediment at the bottom of the bottle. So you know, I think there's no harm in leaving it in a carboy. Now, I think in the email string that was going around, it might have been Ryan or someone else made the comment that, you know, you do want to be careful with that if you're bulk aging in a carboy. You know, I think if there's a significant amount of lees at the bottom of the carboy and you're aging on that, you know, depending on the type of yeast that you're using, that can impart some off flavors. I think just with some of the reading and research that I've done online, some yeasts are more susceptible to that. I think 71B, if I'm not mistaken, may be one that is a little bit more notorious for imparting some off flavors versus other yeasts, like a D47 may actually, you know, aging on some lees may actually impart some more desirable characteristics. I can't necessarily say I've experienced that.
I think that's a bit exaggerated on 71B, but maybe other people are tasting something I'm not.
Yeah, and I'll say, you know, I've even had some bottles with 71B where they're, you know, years old, and like I was saying, I bottled a little prematurely and found some sediment at the bottom, and even aging in the bottle with a little bit of lees for a long, long time, I didn't notice anything. If anything, it just got better with time. You know, it's not like it picked up any real significant off flavors from the lees. You know, one other comment, and this is another thing I don't know with my own experience, something I definitely try to avoid, but if you are going to bulk age in a carboy, you know, be aware, be cognizant of how much headspace you're leaving. I think, you know, minimizing the amount of oxygen that is in the carboy is definitely a good thing, a good practice. You know, earlier Chris was talking about topping up with water, and depending on the style of mead that you're making, that is a good approach to use. I've also heard of other people putting in sanitized marbles or things like that, but what I usually try to do is just like make a little bit extra in primary so that when I rack into my secondary, I'm able to just fill it up all the way to the top and not worry about having any headspace or any excessive headspace there. So I guess to summarize my thoughts on it, definitely bulk aging in a carboy is a really good way to go. And I think as long as you've got water in that airlock, let it go for a year. I don't think you'll have any problems.
Before I move it around the table, one thing that I like about bulk aging in a carboy is it takes up a lot less space than a whole lot of bottles. Although you can, you know, put the bottles in the box that they came in and store the boxes, I just find it just takes up less space by leaving it in the carboy. One thing I want to add to the airspace, Aaron, something that I think I might have said on a previous show, but get yourself, if you're set up and have a CO2 bottle, if not, invest in a CO2 system. Go to the hardware store and pick up an air nozzle and hook it up to your CO2 system. use that to squirt a little CO2 in that headspace in your carboy. That's what I do with my Blickman beer gun. I'll set it up and just hook the CO2 up to it and blast the, the top, the headspace inside all of my carboys. Every time I take the airlock off and go in for a taste, I'll just stick the nozzle of the Blickman in there and squirt off some CO2 and then, cap it back off with the airlock. But, let's move it around the table. Let's go to Chris. What do you think about aging? Chris, what's your thoughts?
Okay, I'll hit this real quickly. If you need to bulk age, definitely do it in bulk in a glass carboy. They're just not permeable. Make sure that your stopper fits really well. Make sure your airlock stays full. Do it in a glass carboy. Now, my personal take on this is make your mead correctly. Use good practice and keep the temperatures in check. Get that thing degassed and clear as quickly as possible. And you're not going to have to bulk age for a year or more. You're going to have mead that's ready to drink.
Good point.
That's my take on it.
Yep.
You remember when I just gave this recipe, I said 30 days in the fridge at 45 degrees. That's degas. That's clearing it out. That's getting all the yeast that'll settle out in that cold temperature, getting all the sediment out. And by the time you've racked it from primary to secondary and then it's set in there 30 days and you go from there to tertiary, a couple of months, you can bottle it up. But ferment that thing cool, feed it right, treat it right, clear it, degas it as soon as you can, and you're going to eliminate your need to let it sit for a year or more.
Yeah. Jeff, any thoughts on aging, carboy, bottle?
To echo what Chris said, yeah, I am a big fan of bulk aging as opposed to aging in a bottle. I know I have definitely had meads that have been sitting in a bottle for well over a year in the case of that Porter Braggot. I come back to that now. It's pretty close to 2.5 years old now. And it does get just a little bit better all the time. But I think, overall, from my experience, bulk aging in like a single vessel is always going to be the better option than aging in individual bottles. You just kind of get the greater interaction of that, the mead kind of working together. Mixing and coming together again, use our best practices. The need to age on my end, since I've adopted a lot of the stuff that we talk about pretty regularly on the show, whether it's like staggered nutrient additions and degassing and, just temperature control, things like that. I have seen a dramatic reduction in the amount of time that my meats have needed to age. I mean, it is staggering actually how fast you can make a good mead compared to like when I started out and I was making stuff that had to sit for a good 6 to 9 months before it was really good and drinkable.
Is it windy where you're at?
Yeah, a little bit.
I can hear it.
There's a storm picking up. I may have to head inside here soon.
let's toss it over to Ryan's side of the table, who usually shows up drinking something that's usually several years old. On occasion, Ryan, what's your thoughts on bulk aging in a carboy versus a bottle?
You know, JD hit the ball. I'm half into the bottle here. So
nail on the head with a hammer. JD hit the nail on the head with a hammer. Okay, let's go.
Sure did. you know, Chris and Jeff are not, they said different things, but they're not disagreeing, even though it might sound like it. Chris is saying that you don't need to age if you have proper methodology and practices in what you're doing. And that's different than what Jeff is saying, in that things can get better with age. And both are correct, and those two are not mutually exclusive. With what I'm saying is, or I should say, it's impossible to do a bench test of taking the same batch and doing a side-by-side taste of the mead that, you know, is 3 months old and one that's 3 years old, just by virtue of what that would mean. But if you've got if you've got a really good practice and you are able to replicate a recipe almost identical, you could do a test of two similar recipes and say, okay, this one I made 2 years ago, this one I made 3 months ago. You know, what's the differences I get? You know, and like I said, the one that you made recently might be very good, but that doesn't mean that the one that aged might not have benefited from some more age. I had run through a list of things that I was going to talk about, or not talk about, but make sure we touched on. Time that you plan to age it, what you're aging it in, the material of what you're aging it in. You know, Chris, I completely agree with, if you're going to do it, I would do glass. I would not age long-term in plastic. You could also age long-term in oak. If you really want to go down that route, I don't think you'd have any issue aging in a year, 2 years or more in oak. The enclosure, we've talked about, we've always been talking about an airlock on this. The risk with the airlock is that you don't want it to dry out and you know, not have that barrier of protection to your liquid. It is possible to use a solid stopper if it's degassed, if there's really nothing else in it, you know, you're not going to create, if there's no additional pressure being created, you could also use a solid stopper in your carboy. I know a lot of home winemakers that do that when they bulk age. You know, the air exposure, we talked about gas and marbles and water, you know, just making sure you're not doing that. And then I think we also talked about the what it's on. You know, I mean, is it on a lot of leaves? Is it, you know, making sure, being aware of what you're sitting on? And then lastly, the last point I'll make is what is it? You know, a sizer is going to improve with age. You know, you're gonna, it's that apple flavor, that honey flavor. I mean, you let that sit for a year, it's gonna be real nice for you. On the other hand, by every bit of conventional wisdom, something like hops don't age quite as well. They lose their bitterness, they lose their aroma. We did taste some very good hopped meads from Aaron that were not new. They were not fresh by any means. You know, I'm using my experience here on the beer end, you know, having an IPA that's, you know, 6 weeks old versus having an IPA that's 6 months old, you are definitely going to notice a deterioration of aroma and bitterness in that latter one. So keeping in mind as well that, you know, it's, if you're not talking about a traditional here, you're talking about something else, or even if you're talking about traditional, some meads will improve with age, some will deteriorate with age, even under optimum conditions. other than that, I think, you know, personal preference. If you want to use natural clearing and natural degassing, you know, things like that, aging will work. But I think I'm trying to be pretty quick here on some of this stuff. But I think that's about it for me.
Yeah, it all makes sense, and I'm sure David will get quite a bit out of that. So I think the bottom line is, yeah, it's okay to age for a long time. Make sure it's in a glass container, whether it's a 1 gallon or a 5 gallon carboy. Make sure it's under airlock. You don't want anything, getting into it. And make sure you know what it is that you're aging. You know, that helps. And, I mean, there's a certain level of maintenance to this whole thing. I mean, even the wines that I do, the grape wines, I've got several that are aging and have been for almost a year now. But there's a certain amount of maintenance to them. You just can't tuck them away and forget about them and pretend they don't exist until you want to get them out and check them. So, make it a habit. Set up a schedule. Make it a habit to check on your aged or your aging rack. Have a rack. Have a place in the closet that you want to age stuff on. But with that, guys, I think we're about out of time here, and I'm going to leave you with this one last thing. While we were on vacation, we spent a couple of days in Las Vegas, stayed at the Paris, had a grand time. I ran across a bottle of Herradura Selección Suprema Tequila, and I bought two of them. The price, $299 bottle. So with that, we'll leave it right there. Come on back next week. Angie and David, hope we helped you out tonight. Looking forward to episode 46 here in a week. Join us, Tom Repas, May 2nd. He'll join us. Major Cup winner, best in show. We'll get his view on things as well. So, guys, what do you think? We come back next week. Do it all over.